stares at a single seed long enough, she can forget what it is. She can even forget it's a seed at all, the way when you say a word over and over again, it loses its meaning. Her mind does funny things like that up in the attic. Time passes. Her hands move deftly while her eyes record the numbers on the scale, her vision seemingly unconnected to her brain. She finishes another sack of tiger lilies and then dumps out a sack of lilies of Peru. She checks the clock. She needs to take a bathroom break. There's only one in the store, and it's directly below her, tucked under the staircase. As she reaches the main floor, she glances over at her father's office. His door is closed, a sign the accounting is not going smoothly. He probably needs some cheering up. Maybe she'll poke her head in and say hi. He likes it when she does that. He always smiles and says in his ultra-serious voice, "All right, Maggie, enough tomfoolery. Back upstairs you go." She quietly inches open the door, expecting to see him hunched over a stack of papers on his desk, his bifocals balanced on the tip of his nose. Instead, she finds him standing behind his desk with his back to her and his pants down, his white buttocks exposed. Maggie realizes he's not alone. Someone she can't quite see through the crack of the door is crouched down in front of him. She watches for a moment, horror-struck and captivated, until her father moans with pleasure and collapses against the desk. And then a woman's voice cries out, "Your daughter!" Maggie lets out a loud gasp. Her father turns around. His face is flushed and sweaty. Whoever he's with tries to stay hidden behind the desk, but her head bobs up for a split second, and Maggie instantly recognizes her golden braids. Clementine. Her father quickly pulls up his pants and looks right at Maggie, struggling with his zipper and belt buckle. Maggie, shocked more by his hubris than by the indiscretion itself, turns and flees.
Maggie!
As he utters her name, she bolts back to the staircase. She hears him say to Clementine,
"I told you this was stupid. You could have locked the door."
She hisses back in French. The door slams. Maggie dashes up to the attic, snatches a handful of seeds, and starts counting mindlessly. The seeds are slippery in her damp, trembling hands. All she can see is the image of her father with his pants down. Moments later, Maggie hears her father on the stairs and contemplates ducking under the table. He steps into the attic with his hair smoothed back in place, and the natural pallor returned to his skin. He paces the floor behind Maggie. She continues counting her seeds one by one. 8, 9, 10, 11. He paces back and forth, rubbing his bald spot with his fingers, sighing, silent, troubled. Still, he does not speak. 14, 15, 16.
"What you saw," he finally says.
"I didn't really—"
"It was an accident."
"An accident?"
"Mm."
"I didn't really see anything."
"It doesn't. It won't."
"I'm not going to say anything." He expels a breath. She isn't sure if it's a sigh of relief or remorse, if it's a sigh at all. He continues to pace behind her quietly for another few minutes, before turning around and descending the flight of stairs. She lets the lily of Peru seeds slide between her fingers, like sand. They walk home together in total silence. Maggie's father makes no attempt at levity. There's none of their usual banter, only the weight of their shared shame hanging between them in the cold. When they finally reach the house, Maggie rushes inside. The kitchen smells of cloves and allspice. She spots three sugar pies lined up on the windowsill. Her mother's at the stove, stirring a giant pot of ragout de boulettes. They must be having company.
"You'd better get ready," Maman says. "Everyone will be here at 7.
"Who's everyone?" her father wants to know.
"I told you I invited the Dion and the Frechettes,"
she says impatiently, turning to give him a disapproving look. She isn't wearing her corset yet, which makes Maggie so furious she has to look away. She resents her mother's sagging breasts and loose belly, wishes she had made more of an effort to preserve her beauty over the years. What happened at the store today can only be her mother's fault.
"I'm in no mood to entertain," her father mutters,
avoiding making eye contact with Maggie.
"It's been a long day."
"Put the beer in the icebox," Maman says, ignoring him. "You walked right past it in the mudroom."
Hours later, the house is alive with music and raucous laughter. At the center of it sits her father, smoking a cigar and slapping a pair of spoons on his knee,
to the tune of Les Filles du Canada, the humiliation of this afternoon seemingly forgotten. Monsieur Dion is accompanying him with the fiddle, and the women are clapping and singing along. Maman opens a window to let in some fresh air.
Ah-ha-ha! They roar. Les Filles du Canada!
Maggie's father helps himself to a long swig of Crown Royal. His cheeks are ruddy and splotched, his eyes glassy. Maggie usually loves it when her parents' rare good moods collide. It's pure serendipity when her father loosens up and morphs into a more vulgar, uninhibited version of himself. And at the same time, Maman relaxes and forgets to be miserable. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, it makes Maggie feel like their family is all right after all, that they're no less happy than other families. But tonight, Maggie's burden lingers, dampening her enjoyment. She can't get out of her mind the image of Clémentine Phoenix hiding behind her father's desk, and its greater implication on their lives. Her father suddenly drops the spoons on the table, jumps to his feet, and pulls Maman to the middle of the room. He holds her tightly around the waist, and expertly swings her around, as though they've done this before many times. And then he dips her, right there in the living room. To Maggie's and everyone else's astonishment, Maman kicks out her leg and tosses her head back blithely, laughing. Everyone applauds, including Maggie, in spite of her confusion. Maybe it's best not to try to understand a thing like marriage, she reasons. Not yet. She's on a different path anyway. Chapter 6
Pass it over, Audrey says, reaching for the cigarette they're sharing. She blows four perfect smoke rings into the air.
It's early spring, and Dunham is thawing. Maggie and Audrey are sitting on the front stoop of the Small Brothers building, where they make the equipment for producing maple syrup. Maggie blossomed over the winter. The onslaught of adolescence is fully upon her. Her legs are longer. She towers over Nan and Audrey now. And although she's still skinny, her breasts have swelled a full cup size. She wears her black hair longer, and instead of the waves curling around her ears in a sweet bob, they now fall to her shoulders, giving her what she thinks is a more sophisticated look. She started wearing red lipstick, which she puts on after school and removes before going home. Audrey hands Maggie the cigarette, and she takes a long drag.
I'm meeting Gabrielle Phoenix here, Audrey confesses.
Gabrielle? Why? Maggie hasn't seen Gabrielle since the fall, except for one brief glimpse when he came home to plant his corn.
He invited me to go to Selby Lake with him, Audrey says, flushing.
Like a date?
Yes, a date.
Maggie blinks.
You have a date with Gabrielle Phoenix? Don't tell anyone, okay, Mags? She says, flicking an ash into the slush at her feet. He's so cute, but he's a frog.
Her long lashes flutter adorably.
It's embarrassing.
Everything about Audrey McCauley makes Maggie feel deficient, from her golden curls to her shiny saddle shoes, to her perfect wasp family. The last time Maggie was at her house, Audrey's mother was wearing a pink tweed dress with pearls, and her father, Dr. McCauley, was reading the newspaper in a winged armchair by the fire. Her little sister was playing the piano beside him. The whole tableau filled Maggie with inexplicable despair. How simple it must be to be one of them, Maggie thought to herself that day. In all the years she's been friends with Audrey, she's never once seen evidence of any sides or opponents, or even any noticeable undercurrents of animosity. They're just a family with a singular common purpose, to be the McCauleys and thereby make others feel inferior. For Maggie to have lost Gabrielle to Audrey makes the defeat all the more insulting.
He's bringing a friend, Audrey says. For you.
I don't want to go. Maggie's voice is drowned out by the roar of motorcycles. Audrey jumps to her feet. Gabrielle and his friend pull up to the curb. Gabrielle looks Maggie up and down as though he's never seen her before. His expression reveals nothing.
Hey, Maggie, he says.
She glares back at him.
This is my friend, Jean-Francois. Everyone calls me J.F., he says,
eyeing Maggie like he's just won first prize. He's not bad-looking. He's got dark eyes and a bluish sheen to his frozen black pompadour. But when he smiles, she notices he's missing a bottom tooth.
Pepsi's in their rotten teeth, her father would say.
Let's go, Gabrielle says.
Audrey climbs on the back of his bike and wraps her arms around his waist. She grins stupidly, and Maggie wants to grab a fistful of her golden waves and pull her right off that motorcycle.
Are you coming?
Gabrielle asks Maggie. Audrey gives her a pleading look. At least if she goes with them, she'll be able to keep an eye on Gabrielle. She gets on the back of JF's bike and notices that not a wisp of his blue pompadour moves in the wind. Maggie's father has warned her about the apocalyptic possibilities of speeding down country roads on a motorcycle, careening into tractors, flipping over into ditches, slamming into utility poles. Last year, a St. Helens girl died on the back of her boyfriend's motorcycle. Maggie closes her eyes. The wind is cold against her face, battering her cheeks until they feel bruised. She feels strangely exhilarated, wishing it were Gabrielle she was holding on to. Selby Lake is at the foot of Mount Pinnacle. Maggie has spent many summer days here grilling under the sun by the water, reading on the veranda of the canteen, chatting with the guests from Pinnacle Lodge. There's a dance at the dance hall every Saturday night, and this summer she'll be old enough to jitterbug until the lights come on. They park in front of the old abandoned Selby barn. The cottages stand empty and abandoned. The only people left after Labor Day are the farmers, who emerge only to cut ice or fish on the frozen lake. It's gray and mournful, and Maggie realizes she's never been here in the off-season. She follows the others inside the barn. The sky through the window is layered pink and orange, glowing like the inside of a pumpkin.
"What's in your pockets?" Gabrielle asks
JF. JF pulls out two bottles of Labatt 50 and a long piece of black licorice. He tosses a beer to Gabrielle. "I'm cold," Audrey says. Gabrielle unzips his leather jacket and hangs it over her shoulders. Audrey reaches for Gabrielle's hand and tugs him toward the loft. It's a famous makeout spot, and Maggie realizes with a sinking heart that Audrey and Gabrielle have been here before. Gabrielle lets Audrey pull him away. He looks back once at Maggie, but she quickly turns away as he follows Audrey up the ladder like a puppy. The moment they're gone, JF lunges at Maggie. There's a look in his eyes that reminds her of a wolf, but she holds her breath and tells herself it's her only chance to make Gabrielle jealous. As his teeth clack against hers, she thinks about his missing tooth and has to suppress a gag. He manages to maneuver her to the ground and get her flat on her back. "My first kiss." JF unbuttons her coat. She doesn't stop him because she doesn't want him to report back to Gabrielle that she's a prude. Besides, the more they do, presumably the worse Gabrielle will feel. He flattens her breast with the palm of his hand. She closes her eyes and resigns herself to his grubby hands on her ribcage. "Ouch," she says. He kneads her breasts, his fingertips icy on her flesh. She lets him grope her for a while before finally pushing him off.
"Hey,"
he cries indignantly.
"Stop, please."
"Maudite anglaise," he mutters.
"You're all prudes."
His breath smells like black licorice and cigarettes. They sit there sullenly, not speaking, until Gabrielle and Audrey finally come down from the loft. By now it's dark, but she can see that Audrey's cheeks are red. She's disheveled and sheepish. Gabrielle has an impassive look on his face. JF gets up and strides out of the barn, making a show of disgust. He doesn't even help Maggie to her feet. Gabrielle doesn't seem at all jealous, which means she kissed that creep for nothing. She trails after Gabrielle and Audrey, utterly miserable. Gabrielle suddenly turns to Maggie and says,
"I'll take you home."
Maggie freezes. Audrey looks perplexed.
"She lives next door to me,"
Gabrielle explains. "So?" Audrey has her hands on her hips.
"It's just easier," he says. "Get on, Maggie."
Maggie's spirits soar.
"Maggie!"
Audrey says angrily. Maggie hesitates. "We're going to the same place, Aud." And then she climbs on the back of Gabrielle's motorcycle and presses her cheek against his back. He revs up his engine and they drive off, leaving Audrey and JF standing in front of the barn by themselves. She doesn't even feel the cold. Gabrielle's clean blonde hair blows in the wind, the way hair should. She wraps her arms even tighter around his waist, inhaling the slope of his neck. Her insides are warm. When they reach Bruce Street, her heart sinks. She wants to keep riding. She would go anywhere with him. But he comes to a stop and Maggie reluctantly gets off.
"Thanks for the ride,"
she says, trying to keep her tone light.
"Did JF try something?"
he asks her. "That's none of your business."
He turns to face her.
I like you, Maggie, he says.
She doesn't know how to respond.
I just wanted you to know.
What about Audrey?
You're the one I've always wanted.
Her mouth goes dry. Did she hear that right?
Your father told me to stay away from you, he says,
pulling her toward him. He did? When?
That day I came up to the attic to talk to you, right before I left for Montreal.
I didn't know.
So, should I?
He asks. What?
Stay away from you.
No. I mean, you don't have to. He's staring at her, unflinching. His face is so close. She leans in slightly, their noses almost touching. Her lids close and she feels his lips on hers, slightly at first, and then with more urgency. His hand moves to the back of her neck, the other one under her chin. He is a beautiful kisser. This will be her first kiss, she decides, erasing all memory of that barbaric experience with JF.
Maggie!
It's her mother. She quickly pulls away from Gabrielle and looks toward her house. The kitchen window is open and she can hear her mother yelling her name into the late afternoon. I have to go, Maggie says.
Meet me outside the small brother's building tomorrow after school, he tells her.
Maggie nods, and he kisses her again. His tongue tastes sweet. She races to her house, not knowing what to expect, and not much caring. Chapter 7 Maggie loves watching Gabrielle move through the field, tending to his corn, opening husks, pulling off tassels. If it gets too hot, he lifts his white t-shirt over his head and stuffs it into the back pocket of his jeans. She follows behind him, smiling, knowing he belongs to her now, as much as this land she loves so much.
It's looking good, Gabrielle says, relieved. That cold spell didn't kill off too many seedlings.
He doesn't have to explain his concerns to her. She knows corn can tolerate some frost in the early seedling stage, but they're more vulnerable when the soil temperature plunges below freezing. This year, the cold weather dragged on well into March, causing the farmers much fretting over their crops. Gabrielle kneels down on one knee and inspects the tufts of silk hanging out of the husks. A light breeze sweeps across the field, dusting it with pollen. The corn grows.
Come, he says.
Where? He pulls her by the hand and they head deep into the field, until they're completely swallowed by the stalks. Let's get lost in here, she says. With school winding down and the weather finally warm, they've been able to spend more time together. Her father is always at work, and her mother prefers the kids to be out of the house as much as possible. Once the chores are done, Maman hardly cares where they go, or what they do, as long as they come running the moment her voice thunders across the field. Maggie and Gabrielle lie down side by side on their backs. Gabrielle flings his arm out and she rests her head on his biceps. The leaf of a stalk tickles her thigh, and she rolls closer to Gabrielle. He's twirling her hair in his fingers, and when he accidentally brushes her cheek with his fingertip, she shivers. I love it here in the field, she says.
Me too.
She props herself up on one elbow and gazes into his face. His eyes are silvery in the sun. Why do you have to go to Montreal all winter? She asks him. He looks at her strangely.
Money, he says. Why else?
He's been working at Canadair, the airplane parts factory, in the off-season since he was 15. It troubles Maggie, the thought of him returning to Montreal for the winter. It's hard for her to enjoy their time together now, to be fully present with him when the deadline looms large, casting its shadow over these precious days. There's nowhere else you can work around here.
I don't mind Canadair, he says. As factory work goes, it's not the worst.
What will happen to us in the fall? She asks him.
It's only June, Maggie, he says. A lot can happen from now to then.
He slides a strand of hair away from her eyes.
You're so pretty, he tells her.
I am?
He laughs. You have no idea. That's why I love you.
She doesn't move. Just lets his words settle over her. I love you too, she whispers. Without another word, he rolls on top of her, and they kiss for a long time. She can feel him growing hard against her thigh. Her shirt is coming undone, her bra being unfastened. She's the one doing the unbuttoning. They've never gone this far before. Her heart is racing. He pushes her skirt up and then hesitates, so she's the one who leads his hand to her thigh.
You sure? He breathes.
Yes. In that moment, she is absolutely fearless, her worries absent. It hurts fiercely, but beneath the pain, or entangled with it, one inseparable from the other, is such excruciating pleasure she has to cry out with every thrust. When he finishes, he collapses on top of her. His jeans and underwear are down around his ankles. His backside is wet, his hair drenched. Her arms are wrapped around his torso. Suddenly he seems so vulnerable. They lie there like that for a long time, and he stays inside her. For no reason, she starts to cry. He lifts his head, alarmed.
Why are you crying? He asks. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have.
No, she says. I wanted to.
Then why are you crying? He asks her.
Happiness.
I really do think I love you, he says.
She knows boys lie, especially for sex, but she believes him. His eyes don't lie. His pounding heart is not lying. He drops his head back down, resting it on her shoulder. She closes her eyes and the afternoon slowly slips away. And then, as usual, her mother's voice shatters the stillness, echoing throughout the field.
Maggie!
Gabriel jumps to his feet and pulls up his pants.
You better go, he says,
sounding afraid.
She'll kill us both with that goddamn wooden spoon of hers.
Maggie laughs and fastens the clasp of her bra, buttons her shirt, pulls up her panties, and straightens her skirt over her bloodstained thighs. He takes her by the hand and helps her to her feet, and they walk solemnly out into the world. The weight of it presses down on her. She's done the very thing she's been warned against since the onset of puberty. Not just sex, but sex with a French boy. She's given herself to him, and there's no turning back now. She can see her mother waving the pig spoon, making wild gestures in the doorway, looking ridiculous.
What are you doing with him?
Maman cries out, even though Maggie is still only midway up the hill.
Va-t'en,
she tells Gabrielle.
Meet me in the field tomorrow at 3,
he whispers, and her heart flutters. His motorcycle is parked in a clearing by the road. He gets on, revs it up, and speeds away. They don't even have time to kiss goodbye. I was reading in the field, Maggie says, approaching her mother. Gabriel happened to be there. He's a farmer, remember? She manages to slip past into the kitchen. There's soup bubbling on the stove. The radio is on low, and she recognizes Tino Rossi's voice, which her mother adores. The butter, flour, and sugar are all laid out on the counter in preparation for Maman's Saturday baking. A pot of coffee sits on the pine table.
Violet says she saw you on his motorcycle the other day,
Maman says.
So?
Thwack. The pig spoon on Maggie's behind.
Stop it!
Maggie cries, knowing she's too old for these beatings.
You're forbidden to ride on motorcycles, remember?
She says, her arm in the air, poised for another smack.
I'm almost 16, Maggie reminds her. He's my boyfriend, whether you like it or not.
Her mother steps back with a strange expression on her face.
You're just like him, she says, shaking her head. Who? Your father. You're both English snobs who like to screw French Canadians.
Maggie is stung by the remark, but it bolsters her.
I love him, she says defiantly. Love him?
Maman repeats.
Who do you think you are? One of those dimwits from your romance magazines?
Maggie's face blazes. She looks around the room for something to throw. Maman is watching her, knowing exactly what could happen next. Maybe they're alike in that way. The short fuse, the temper. Maggie's eyes light on the pot of coffee. Her mother smiles.
I dare you, her dark eyes challenge.
But Maggie has enough restraint not to do the thing her mother would do. Instead, she runs upstairs to her room and slams the door, worried about how her mother will retaliate. Chapter 8.
They drive past miles and miles of yellow cattail grass, growing wild on the side of the road, while the Amasca River flows alongside them in perfect sync with the speed of Gabrielle's motorcycle. It's the beginning of summer, and Maggie appreciates all of it with fresh eyes today. This scenery she can sometimes take for granted. The barns with their rusted corrugated tin roofs, the silos and the cows, the endless cornfields glinting gold in the sunshine. Everything with Gabrielle seems shinier, more worthy of her attention. Every smell is more fragrant, every color more intense. She loves this boy, whose solid torso she holds onto for safety. She loves this endless road and the wind whipping her hair into her face. In front of her lie miles and miles of possibility. Gabrielle is so much more than her father's narrow-minded caricature of French Canadians. He'll never understand the depth and complexity of Gabrielle's heart, his loyalty. He fiercely loves Maggie, his sisters, his little niece. He would do anything for them. The other day he beat up a guy who told Angèle she looked like an ape, and his eyes fill with tears whenever he talks about how Clémentine raised him, about their poverty and the mistreatment of the Québécoises in their own province. It hasn't been easy for them to be a couple. Gabrielle's friends dislike Maggie, with her tartan kilts and penny loafers, and her English Protestant father. She's the symbol of all the injustices and indignities they've ever suffered. In their world, there are two distinct sides, and no one can ever fall in between or cross over to the other side. French and English, Catholics and Protestants. Maggie, with her mixed blood and incompatible religions, will never be one of them. Gabrielle points to the sign for Saint-Angèle de Monnoir and turns off. When he brings the bike to a stop along the side of the river, he turns to Maggie and says,
"My mother was born here."
"You must miss them."
"I guess so,"
he responds, tensing. He rarely talks about his parents. Every once in a while he mentions how young his father was when he died, usually in reference to his own mortality, but never more than that. Everything Maggie knows about Gabrielle's father is from town gossip. He gets off the bike and helps Maggie off. She hands him his knapsack and he pulls out a blanket and a bottle of wine in a brown paper bag. They sit cross-legged on the blanket. He pours them each a paper cup of wine. "What do you want to do when you grow up?" she asks him, realizing they've never talked about it before. "What do you want to be?" He looks at her blankly.
"Be? I don't know. I'd run our farm if Clémentine wasn't such a pain in the ass. I'll probably wind up a foreman at Canadair."
Maggie smiles, covering her disappointment.
"I know I don't want to die with nothing," he adds. "My father died with nothing, and he left us with nothing."
"You could be anything," she encourages. "You're smart enough." Gabrielle shrugs.
"I love working the field," he admits. "But Clémentine is in charge and she's too bossy. She treats me like a kid."
"Maybe you could have your own farm," Maggie suggests. He doesn't answer. "Whatever you decide, you'll be successful," she tells him, wrapping her arms around his neck. They make love. Afterwards, they lie lazily under the sun for a long time, ignoring the ants crawling all over their legs.
"I pulled out," he mentions, "so you don't have to worry."
She looks at him and smiles, relieved. "I'm so happy here with you," she says.
Me too."
When the sun finally begins to drop and the sky fades to pink, they head back to Dunham, silent and content. Gabrielle pulls over at the gas station outside of town.
"There's a rattling noise," he explains. "I'm going to leave the bike here to get it checked out."
As they approach the corner of Principal and Bruce Streets, walking hand in hand, Maggie notices a gang of kids from Cohensville High milling around in front of the Small Brothers building. Now that school is out, they mostly hang out on the street, waiting for something to happen. Maggie spots Audrey in the middle of the pack, and her heart sinks. They haven't been close since Maggie started dating Gabrielle. Audrey has a whole new clique of friends now, and a new boyfriend from Cohensville High, though she's held on to her old attitude of entitlement. As Maggie and Gabrielle pass, Audrey's boyfriend, a stocky redhead, says loud enough for Gabrielle to hear,
"Well, if it isn't Maggie Hughes slumming with her Pepsi bow."
"Oh, Barney, be quiet," Audrey scolds, mock angry. "Ignore him, Mags." Maggie looks nervously at Gabrielle.
What did you call me?
Gabriel says, taking a step toward Barney.
I'm sorry, I don't speak Pepsi,
Barney says, puffing up his chest. His friends join in, egging him on. Pea soup, Pepsi. Gabriel's eyes get that dangerous steely look, and his hands ball into fists.
Maggie steps back.
Before Barney even has a thought of self-defense, Gabriel's right fist cracks into his jaw. Barney stumbles back, shocked. The Cohensville High boys encircle Gabriel and start throwing punches at him. Audrey and Maggie scream helplessly. Gabriel, dangerously outnumbered, is getting pummeled. He crouches down to deflect the barrage of blows, and then someone yells, "The pea soup's got a knife!" The English boys suddenly retreat and disperse, leaving Gabriel standing alone on the street, holding up his dead father's pocket knife.
"What's going on here?"
Maggie turns to see her father getting out of his car. He marches angrily toward them.
"What is going on here? This degenerate pulled a knife," Barney cries.
Maggie's father looks from Barney to Maggie in confusion.
"They ganged up on him," she explains.
"He punched me in the jaw," Barney moans, rubbing his chin. "All my friends did was help me out. Then he pulled that knife."
Maggie's father turns to Gabriel, who hasn't uttered a single word in his own defense, nor seems inclined to. He makes no attempt to conceal the knife either.
"Get in the car, Maggie," says her father.
She looks over at Gabriel. He doesn't meet her gaze.
"Go,"
her father orders. Then, turning to Barney, he says calmly,
"Son, I'm on your side, but you should know better than to taunt someone like him."
With that, he drags Maggie to the Packard and gives her a push into the front seat. She's so ashamed of her father's bigotry, of Gabriel for pulling the knife, of herself for doing nothing. She can't even bring herself to look at Gabriel. As she drives off with her father, though, she watches him standing there in the street, stone-faced, with the knife still clenched in his hand. His nose is bleeding, his lips swollen, his white t-shirt torn to shreds. He stays there for as long as she can see him in the rearview mirror. Later that night, after everyone has gone to bed, Maggie hovers outside her father's sanctuary. She watches the cigar smoke curl up from under the door and knocks tentatively.
"Come in,"
he says. She's always loved this room. It's such a man's world, the very essence of her father. There are radio parts on the table and homemade radios, some finished, others mid-dissection, all over the floor. There's a stack of empty House of Lords cigar boxes on the shelf he built, alongside all his books, Handbook for Gardeners, Operating a Garden Center, Native Trees of Canada, Dale Carnegie's How to Stop Worrying and Start Living.
"What do you think of Petunia Color Parade for the cover of next season's catalog?"
he asks her. "I like it."
"Remember last year's?" he says, handing her the 48 catalog.
She opens it and leafs through the pages. Cosmos Mandarin. First new all double cosmos. The large bright orange flowers have as many as 40 to 50 petals, making them really double. But even more impressive is the foliage. 64 pages of single-spaced typeface. She holds it with the kind of reference one might reserve for a precious work of art, admiring Peter's hand-drawn diagrams of wooden pot labels, bamboo cane stakes, plant ties, and hose nozzles.
"Next year I'm looking into using real photographs," her father says. "Wouldn't that be sophisticated?"
"Very," Maggie says, pulling down one of the tattered books from his shelf. "Sow seed generously," she reads aloud. "One for the rook, one for the crow, one to die and one to grow. I remember you used to read that to me." She runs her finger along the spine of a field guide for wildflowers.
"You can do better than a French Canadian," he says.
"You didn't."
"It's different,"
he says, putting the catalog back on the shelf.
"Your mother's not the one who had to earn the living."
Smoke from his panatella fills the room.
"Besides, I've acknowledged my mistake. You can learn from it."
She remembers, "You can't change them." "Why did you marry her?" she asks him. He looks at her wearily and sighs, offering a single defeated word as a way of explanation.
"Lust," he says. "She's always had a strange power over me. Still does."
As soon as he says it, Maggie understands the way Gabriel makes her feel.
It's the reason her parents can sometimes hate each other and still want to dance together and have sex. Now it has a name. Lust.
You're forbidden to see him, Maggie. Do you hear me?
Those English boys started it today.
He's a hoodlum. He's not our kind, and you deserve better. This is not how I raised you.
Her head buzzes at his hypocrisy. She wants to scream, "And what about Clementine?" But she holds back, too terrified to crack the fragile wall of silence and denial they tacitly erected that day. It is the only way their relationship can be sustained. "I'm not cattle," she says. "Why can't you let me be happy?"
"I, of all people, know you can't be happy with him."
"He's not Maman."
"Isn't he, though?"
She doesn't answer.
"Please don't cross me on this, Margaret."
"You can't tell me who to love," she says, daring to defy him for the first time in her life. "I can love whoever I want." He smiles thinly, his lips disappearing, and she has the fleeting thought that the two things she wants most in the world, Gabrielle's love and her father's approval, cannot coexist, and that one will eventually have to be sacrificed for the other. Chapter 9. The next morning, when Maggie comes downstairs, she notices a suitcase by the back door. Her mother is making bread, working the dough with her fists.
"Who's leaving?"
Maggie asks.
"You are,"
Maman responds, giving the dough a hard punch. Maggie opens the suitcase, and her heart plunges when she sees her clothes, neatly pressed and folded. She must have slept through her mother's packing.
"Where?"
she asks, panicking.
"Where am I going?"
"You've got a summer job on your Uncle Yvonne's farm,"
she says. Her aunt and uncle live on a dairy farm in Frelixburg, about 6 miles away from Dunham. They don't visit very often because of Deda's weight. It's hard for her to move around. Alfreda, they call her Deda, must weigh close to 300 pounds. All of Maggie's memories of her involve her elephantine shape moored into an absurdly small pressed-back chair. Even the most negligible movements leave her panting and spent. Maman rarely visits them because Deda is too fat to clean, and their house is filthy. In spite of that, Maggie likes her aunt. She's affectionate and warm, with a robust laugh that emanates from the depths of her enormous belly. Her father comes into the room then, and Maggie turns to him.
"Was this your idea?"
she asks him.
"Settle down, Maggie," says her father.
"I don't want to work on Yvonne's farm," she says. "I want to keep working with you at the seed store."
"Yvonne can pay you much better wages."
"I don't care about better wages. I want to stay here."
"It's just one summer."
Her mind is whirling. What about Gabrielle? What if he leaves for Montreal before she gets back?
"Please don't make me go," she says.
They don't understand. She can't be away from Gabrielle or the seed store.
"Yvonne got a contract selling his milk to Guaranteed," her father explains. "It's a big deal for them, so you see, this isn't about you, Maggie. He needs someone to help out on the farm, and frankly, we could use the extra money."
"I was 11 years old when I started supporting my family,"
Maman says, wiping her hands on her flower-covered apron.
"Don't worry. You can keep some of it," her father promises,
adjusting his Panama hat.
"Now go say goodbye to your sisters."
"I'm not going," she says. "You can't force me."
But even as the words leave her mouth, she knows she's already lost the battle. She's 15. What can she do? Run off with Gabrielle and get married? Live in poverty in his shack or at his uncle's apartment in Montreal? She underestimated her parents.
"Go on."
Maggie doesn't move. She looks desperately from one to the other, silently beseeching them to change their minds.
"I said go,"
her father repeats, raising his voice.
"I hate you both,"
Maggie cries, running from the room. She climbs the stairs slowly, feeling a crushing sense of shock and betrayal. How can he do this to her? She hugs and kisses her sisters, sobbing and clinging to them.
"Are you ever coming back?"
Jerry asks, wide-eyed.
"In the fall," Maggie says. "If they let me."
She kisses Nicole's plump red cheek one last time, grabs a few things her mother didn't bother to pack, notepaper, pencil box, makeup, a handful of romance magazines, and returns to the kitchen in defeat.
I know you're doing this to keep me away from Gabrielle, she says.
Her father finishes his coffee and doesn't respond. Maman turns slightly, her expression unreadable. She approaches Maggie and pecks her on the head.
It's not forever, she says.
Maggie's exile is probably the first thing her parents have agreed on in years. Her father takes her suitcase to the car. Gabrielle doesn't have a telephone, so she can't even call him to say goodbye. She runs outside and searches Gabrielle's property, hoping to spot him.
Can I just go and say goodbye?
She asks her father.
There's no time, Maggie, he says. I have to get you to Frelixburg and then back in time to open the store.
Please!
It's too early in the morning for all this melodrama, he says. Stop fancying yourself, Juliet, and get in the car.
They drive the 15 minutes to Frelixburg in silence. Maggie stares grimly out the window.
Gorgeous day,
her father chirps. She looks over at him, seething. He starts to whistle. He whistles the rest of the way to the farm, while she composes an impassioned letter to Gabrielle in her head. Frelixburg is a small town nestled at the bottom of a steep, winding hill, and sandwiched between the Saint-François d'Assise Catholic Church and the Holy Trinity Anglican Church. The Pike River flows right through the middle, clearly marking the town's boundaries, French on one side, English on the other. In the cemetery behind the Saint-François d'Assise Church, the stones are marked Touchettes, Piettes, Goyettes. At the Anglican cemetery, there are the Whitcombs, Byrons, Spencers. Even dead, the French and English remain segregated. When they pull up to the farm, Dida is waiting for them outside in a rocking chair. She's wearing a loose, stained frock and slippers. She manages to get up and meet them halfway, already flushed and out of breath. Maggie's father doesn't even go inside the house. He unloads her suitcase, sets it down on the side of the road, pecks her on the cheek, and gets back in his Packard.
Can't be late for work,
her father calls out, rolling down his window.
Take care, my black beauty.
And then he drives off, his tires kicking up a cloud of gravel as he goes. Maggie watches him disappear, feeling abandoned, bereft, hating him, but longing for him to turn back for her just the same.
Come, cocotte, says her aunt,
appearing next to her and putting a fat arm around her shoulder.
Let's go find your uncle.
The one thing Maggie can be grateful for is that her aunt and uncle are both easygoing and fun, especially Yvonne. Even Maman melts when he's around, laughing at his jokes and fawning all over him because he was in the war. He still wears his soldier's uniform with a forest green wedge cap to all their holiday parties, even though he's been back almost 5 years. He sings war songs and always smells of wet wool, whiskey, and brill cream.
You get more beautiful all the time, he says,
pulling Maggie into his arms.
How old are you now? 16?
15, she responds, barely recognizing him out of his uniform. He shakes his head in disbelief. He has a glorious pile of wavy black hair that parts naturally in the middle and falls over his eyelids in the shape of a heart. He's very handsome in spite of the big stomach that now bulges over the top of his belt buckle. Maggie looks around, remembering why her mother doesn't like to visit. Their house is dark and gloomy. The drab Victorian furniture is all in tones of maroon and deep brown, and Maggie can see that everything is dirty. There are dust minou floating around on the wood floors, cobwebs in the corners, mucky boots and shoes piled in a heap by the door, and discarded Union des Producteurs Agricoles newspapers stacked on the floor in the foyer. Dida notices Maggie looking around and says,
It'll be nice to have help around here. It's odd for me to manage.
Maggie can't wait to give the place a good cleaning. Dida slices up some fresh bread and pours Maggie a glass of unpasteurized milk. It reminds her of Nicole's spit-up.
You'll get used to it, Dida says cheerily.
They go upstairs to see Maggie's room, which is as dark as the rest of the house. There's one small lamp on the bedside table, which does little to brighten it up. Do you mind if I lie down for a bit? She says. I'm tired.
Of course, Cocotte.
When she's alone, Maggie climbs into the iron bed and pulls the patchwork quilt up to her nose. It's scratchy and heavy and weighs almost as much as she does. Like all the quilts in her mother's family, it's made from the wool-worsted remnants of men's suits. Herringbone, houndstooth, pinstripes, tweed. It smells of cedar. Maggie cries softly. Everything is strange here. The darkness is darker, the air heavier. She misses her pretty wallpaper and fresh sheets that smell of soap, her sister's warm bodies in the bed. She can't stop thinking of Gabrielle. After a while, she pulls out some notepaper and a pencil and writes out the letter she composed in her mind on the way here. June 28th, 1949. Dear Gabrielle, I'm sorry I couldn't say goodbye. There was no time. I've been sent to Frelixburg to work on my uncle's dairy farm under the pretext of my family needing the money. But we all know I've been banished here to keep me away from you. I will send letters as often as I can. Wait for me, my love. They can't keep us apart. Yours forever, Maggie. The days unravel quietly, without any of the tense eruptions she's used to at home. Maggie's job is to help with le train, which is what the farmers call their morning routine. She cleans the cow stalls, collects eggs from the coop, washes and plucks feathers off dead chickens. She also helps Dada with the cooking and cleaning, which isn't so bad because her hard work is always rewarded with praise and accolades. If she misses a grease stain on the stove, Dada never notices. She's just happy to have a clean glass and fork at mealtime. By the time Maggie falls into bed at night, she hasn't the energy to feel sorry for herself or lie awake mourning her separation from Gabrielle. She just sleeps.
Pluck the feathers right out, Dada instructs.
She's teaching Maggie how to pluck a chicken.
Like this. Don't be afraid to hurt the bird. He's already dead.
They're sitting side by side on the porch, staring at the tender pink bellies of two chickens in their laps. There's a stream of sweat trickling down the side of Dida's face as she works.
That's good, Maggie, she encourages. And then the feathers go right into this barrel. I save them for stuffing pillows.
Maggie tosses a handful of feathers into the barrel. A breeze sweeps across the porch, and some of them blow away and land in Dida's hair. She giggles and shakes her head. In spite of everything, there are still moments of pleasure.
You must have a boyfriend in Dunham,
Dida remarks, reaching for another chicken.
A girl as pretty as you? What's his name? I won't say anything.
Gabrielle, Maggie confesses, dying to talk about him with someone. She mailed her letter to him on her first day at the farm, and now she's waiting for his response.
Gabrielle was the angel who told Mary she would bear a son that would be the savior of the world, Dida explains. I suppose it's his letter you're waiting for.
Maggie looks away.
I envy you, Dida says. Having all that in front of you, you can still pick the right man, someone who will make you happy.
I can't wait to go back, Maggie says. They can't keep us apart forever. Eventually they'll have to accept us together.
And he'll wait for you?
Yes, I think so, Maggie says, sounding more confident than she feels. She puts her chicken down and turns to her aunt. Are my parents happy together, do you think? Dida gives her a bewildered look.
You live with them, she says. You'd know better than me.
I know, but they fight so much. And then they dance together. Dida laughs.
That's about right.
Maggie waits for something more. But that's all Dida says. The next morning, there's a letter for Maggie in the mailbox.
I'm terrible at writing. I'm coming to see you. Saturday at noon in front of the church.
GP. On Saturday, Maggie washes her hair and puts on the one Sunday dress her mother packed. She tells Dida she's going to town to buy stamps and have a soda at Freshie's. Dida smiles. Gabrielle is already waiting for her in front of the Saint-François d'Assise church when she arrives. He climbs off his bike and she runs to him. He pulls her into his arms and inhales the smell of her hair. They stand there holding each other for a long time before she even lifts her head. She can barely look at him, like not being able to look straight at the sun.
I miss you,
she says, bursting into tears.
It's only been a week, he says, stroking her hair.
He leads her into the cemetery behind the church.
There's no cornstalks, but it'll do.
I don't have much time, she says. An hour, maybe? They sit on the grass and she lays her head in his lap. It's hard being here all alone, she tells him. By the time I get back to Dunham at the end of the summer, you'll be leaving for Montreal.
I can come home on weekends to see you. Or maybe you'll come with me.
I still have school, she reminds him. I have to finish.
Why?
The question startles her. The answer should be self-explanatory. She feels a slight dip of disappointment, but quickly shoves it aside. She wants their reunion to be perfect. He lies down beside her, and they kiss and nuzzle among the tombstones for a while.
How is it here?
He asks her. Lonely, she says. But my aunt and uncle are nice.
Your parents must sure want to keep you away from me.
After what happened with Barney,
you think that was my fault?
You didn't have to pull the knife.
You didn't have to get in your father's car and leave me alone in the street.
She looks away.
You are a lot like him,
Gabrielle points out, and he means it as an insult, just like her mother did. Well, from what I hear, you're a lot like your father, she fires back.
I'm not my father.
She shrugs, wanting to hurt him. Anyway, she says, I'm glad I'm like my dad. Gabrielle is quiet for a few minutes, and just when she thinks he's moved on and they'll be able to lie down in the grass and kiss and touch each other, he says,
You think you're better than me?
I do not.
I hate the way you looked at me that day in town.
What way?
The way your father looks at me.
That isn't true, she says. You're looking for a reason to fight with me.
You were ashamed of me.
You shouldn't have pulled the knife. Gabrielle lies back, pulling Maggie down with him.
Your father thinks he can stop us being together,
he murmurs, running his hand up her calf, her thigh, between her legs. Is that what this is about? She asks, as his hand inches closer to her panties. Besting my father? He doesn't answer. And then she feels his finger inside her and she cries out. Turning her head to the side, she finds herself facing one of the tombstones. She closes her eyes. The neighbors and farmhands start showing up around dusk for Deda and Yvonne's party, which they've warned her happens every Saturday night. They love a good party. Maybe the loud music and constant clamor of people in their home fills the silence of having no children. As the sky grows dark, the fiddle comes out of the closet, the gin and the cards are laid out on the table, and the floor begins to thump from the square dancing. Yvonne hands Maggie the crown royal. She takes the bottle and swigs from it. Her chest burns and she feels warm inside. Yvonne begins to dance her around the living room. Dida is in her chair, clapping her hands. Yvonne's arms are around Maggie's waist. He's looking at her fondly.
I always wanted a daughter,
he yells in her ear. He's holding her tight, dancing with her to the fiddle. The room is hot and swirling. She's starting to feel nauseated from the whiskey and Yvonne's tight grip on her. She's noticed lately the way he stares at her while she's performing the most banal tasks, hanging up sheets, squeezing lemons, chasing after chickens. Until now, she's taken his attention for paternal fondness, nothing more. But something about the way he's pressing up against her now makes her want to escape. When the song ends, she slips away and goes upstairs to her room. She flops down on the bed, holding onto the mattress, willing herself not to throw up. She yanks the old quilt up over her face, hoping the weight of it and its coolness might be able to keep the liquor inside her. She prays for morning, for the nausea to subside, to feel like herself again. Sometime later, possibly minutes, possibly hours, she hears creaking in the hallway outside her room. The door opens. She attempts to sit up, but her body doesn't cooperate. She lies there, paralyzed, wondering who's in the room with her. Is it time to start le train? She mutters. A man's laughter. Yvonne.
No, Maggie, he says. It's 2 o'clock in the morning.
She groans. When he lies down beside her, she stares at him in confusion. She's so drunk she can barely move. It begins to murmur things in her ear. So beautiful. Can't stop thinking about you. Can't control myself anymore. Want you. She's lucid enough to know that what he's saying is wrong. Her body tenses. She wants to cry for help, but nothing comes out of her mouth. She tries to roll away, but his leg across her body is so heavy. Her stomach lurches. Has she led him on? He's her uncle. She's always adored him. Did she give him the wrong impression? His breath is whiskey and cigarettes. She remembers that afternoon with Jean-Francois at Selby Lake. The revulsion, the smell of licorice on his breath. She squirms while Yvonne slurs in her ear. Dirty, inappropriate words that make her cringe. He's half on top of her now, his leg pinning her down. His arm around her, holding the side of her face with his hand.
Stop, she begs. Monanque, please.
When his fingers begin to unbutton her dress, bile comes up in her throat. His hands move all over her, exploring parts of her body she thought only Gabrielle would ever know. He presses his full weight down on her so she can't even raise a leg to knee him in the groin. Her panties come off. She attempts to twist away, but it's impossible. She hears herself crying and pleading with him, but Yvonne doesn't hear. Or he doesn't care. Maybe the words aren't coming out. She isn't sure anymore. He forces her to touch him, but she fights. She uses every ounce of strength she's got left to resist. Frustrated, Yvonne unbuckles his belt and shoves his pants down. He's breathing hard, pushing himself inside her. She remembers making love to Gabrielle just a few hours earlier. How pleasurable and sweet it was. The thought of Gabrielle now is unbearable. She makes herself focus on the usually comforting noises around her. The crickets, the pipes, the fading music from downstairs. On an ordinary night, all these can lull her to sleep with their soothing rhythm. But now she finds them deafening. Finally, Yvonne collapses beside her on his back, panting like the farm dogs after they're done chasing the cows.
You're not a virgin, he remarks,
staring up at the ceiling. His tone is a blend of surprise and disappointment.
A lucky little boy on the motorcycle, he says,
lighting a cigarette. Maggie watches its orange tip crackle as it burns. She rolls away from him. The room is spinning, and her hand encircles the bedpost to keep it steady. She squeezes her legs together against the pain. Chapter 10 Maggie's parents come to visit for the first time at the end of August. Not to see her, but to celebrate Yvonne's birthday. She's been in Frelixburg all summer, and although she speaks to her parents on the phone every Sunday night, she hasn't seen them since the morning she was sent away. Their conversations are always strained. She quietly pleads with them to let her come home, but the answer is always the same. After Labor Day. She knows they're waiting for Gabrielle to go back to Montreal. Her anger toward them has dulled over the months and given way to hopelessness. She doesn't have the stamina for anger. When she hears their voices over the phone, first her mother, then her father, asking how she's doing, she wants to tell them what's happened to her. She wants them to know what Yvonne has done. She blames them and thinks they should bear the burden with her, but she says nothing. What if they don't believe her? What if her father doesn't come back for her? Yvonne came to her room one more time since that first night and tried to get into her bed. He was drunk and muttering about how he couldn't keep away from her, but she stopped him cold with her voice.
Don't come near me, or I'll tell my father, she said.
Sober, she was a much more valiant opponent. She couldn't see his face in the dark, but she guessed from his silence he was surprised. He'd underestimated her. He backed out of the room that night, warning her not to do anything stupid, and hasn't come to her bed since. Gabrielle has been back only once since that awful night with Yvonne. He knew something was wrong the moment he saw her in the Frelixburg cemetery. She could barely look at him or touch him. She was quiet, distant. They did not make love. She had to lie and tell him it didn't feel right, doing it in the cemetery.
Is something wrong? He finally asked.
No,
she lied. Just a stomachache. The thought of any man touching her or kissing her now filled her with revulsion.